last hour we looked at the Constitution, a document that can, if it is observed as we have always observed it in this country, stand as an obstacle to what seems to be the dream of a new world order. And the question we have is, if the Soviet Union can be targeted, if the Constitution can at least draw attention from those who are anxious to restructure our world, what about people who seem to stand in the way? Could there be any plans for Adventism? Our topic for this hour is Adventism and the New World Order. Well, in the rarefied atmosphere where the world's great plans are laid, where the planners sit and all the forces and factors that matter in this world are identified and categorized and analyzed, you as an Adventist have not gone unnoticed. You have been noticed. Along with a few other small religious groups, you even have a collective name. They have a term they apply to you collectively, along with a few other small religions. You are called the minimalists or the provincial globalists. Those are two relatively interchangeable terms that are used to describe you. In Keys of This Blood, page 285, there is a description of what a minimalist or provincial globalist looks like. And I'm quoting, "They expect that their religious outlook, now shared by a minimum of human beings, will become the absolute norm for a restricted number who will achieve eternal happiness." That's how they size you up. Now, are they right or are they wrong? I think they're much more right than we might be comfortable recognizing or admitting. They understand who we are and who we claim to be. We do indeed recognize that we constitute a small minimum of human beings. We believe this truth will become an absolute norm in something called the end of time. And we feel, sadly, that Jesus was quite correct when he said the narrow way is found by only a few. So we are the minimalists. Well, your religious beliefs, your political convictions, even your missionary activities have all been carefully noted, analyzed, and cataloged. For example, those who have noticed you have noticed that, quote, "You engage in very active and well-heeled missionary work in which you," quote, "compete with Roman Catholic missionizing attempts." And we do. Matter of fact, I think this church is still at or near the top per capita of people who give for missionary activity. There used to be no question about it. It's slipping a little bit because times are hard and maybe our priorities are shifting a little bit. Maybe they shouldn't shift. But nonetheless, we are noticed as people who get out there and engage so successfully in missionary work that we are seen as competition. Now, considering the fact that we consist of about 5 or 6 million people and the other church that is referred to in that statement consists of 1 billion, I think that's a pretty good track record. Well, those who notice these things have noticed that you place your, quote, "central hopes for victory in the arrival of some particular day of the Lord." Are they right? They understand you. They noticed that you, quote, "arose within the context of rebellion against the authority and privileged teaching of the Roman Catholic Church." Well, I guess we'll have to confess we did. We're products of the Reformation. Adventism arose from the ultimate act of the Reformation, that is, transplanting the concept of religious liberty to a new landmass where it would be safe. So yes, indeed, I guess we have to admit that we arose within the context of rebellion against the authority and privileged teaching power of the Roman Church. They have noticed that you are, quote, homegrown products of the United States, formed in the very womb of Western democratic principles about the rights of man. And they've noticed that you, quote, accept the latter-day American interpretation of the wall that separates church and state. You notice that phraseology, the latter-day American interpretation of a wall? And then the Chief Justice says the wall of separation is a metaphor useless for judging and should be explicitly abandoned. In other words, you've been noticed. That's the point I'm trying to make. You've been noticed, and I think rather accurately analyzed. Now then, the clincher in that is that your interest, and I'm quoting again, your interest for John Paul lies in the element of opposition to him that you represent. What will the result of all this be? In the situation rooms of the world where great movements are planned and actions are taken to bring them into life, there's a plan for your future. Let me read it to you. Keys of This Blood, page 292. The provincial globalist will either, quote, become thoroughly and realistically globalized, or they will lose their identity as operative parts of a new world order. Now, friends, that's why I'm here this weekend and not home with my family. Because this stuff is happening. This is out of the theorizing stage. This has progressed apparently far enough that those who believe these things feel safe in publishing it to the world. The only assumption you can make when you disclose your plan is that there's no way anybody can reverse it. And so you will become thoroughly and realistically globalized, or you will lose your identity as operative parts in a new world order. Now here from page 291 is the clincher. You are, quote, destined to undergo a series of severe shocks and mutations as willy-nilly you adapt yourselves to the new globalism emanating from the more powerful groups. Shocks and mutations. Those are the words of Malachi Martin. Shocks and mutations. What do you mean by that, Father Martin? What do you mean? Shocks, I understand. I'm a history major. I took a year of graduate work in history. I think I understand shocks. There's 1,260 years worth of shocks when this world applied shocks against the little groups of minimalists who didn't see it the way the majority did. Shocks, I understand. But what do you mean, Father, by the term mutations? What does that one mean? Mutation. Well, once in a while it's nice to have a dictionary, isn't it? Don't use one very often, but when the words get beyond three syllables, it's kind of nice, you know, to have a backup. So I looked it up. Guess what Webster says a mutation is? It's a permanent change in hereditary character. Change of character. You may look similar, but you are no longer yourself. You have changed, perhaps subtly and almost unnoticed, into something you never intended to be. Mutation. Say, could that happen to a church? How? In the Roman Catholic Church, there is a special order. I described this morning, when I talked about the battle for the mind, as to how that order was established. I won't repeat myself now. But it is a special religious order called Societas Jesu, the Society of Jesus. They had been in this world a little while, and some of their critics kind of poked a slang word at them, said, "You're just Jesuits." And they said, "We like that title fine, we'll use that one too." And so they entered history, understandably called Jesuit, the Jesuit order. They began in 1540, just as Martin Luther was sweeping Europe with Reformation. I'm going to stop a little bit and let this delightful background noise just kind of drift by, because we are taping this, and I'd kind of like to have a clean copy for Kathy's tape over there, okay? Thank the Lord for these machines. They make life easier for us, don't they? Yes, they do. Thank you. I entirely concur with that remark. Well, I think it's kind of done its thing. So back in 1540, just as Martin Luther was sweeping Europe with Reformation, a little 5-foot-1-inch monk came into the papal palace of Pope Paul III. And he said, "Holy Father, the church is in real trouble. Give us authority that no order has ever had before." And the result was the Society of Jesus. Now, in Father Malachi Martin's words, in his book, The Jesuits, he puts it this way: "Never before in the world's history has such a society appeared. There was no continent where Jesuits did not reach, no known language they did not speak, no culture they did not penetrate. The Jesuits carried the battle right into the territories of the papal enemies. They debated in Protestant universities." Hey, how'd they get in there? He doesn't tell us, but he says they were there. "They debated in Protestant universities. They instructed church councils. They infiltrated hostile territories in disguise. Their constant theme, the Bishop of Rome is successor to St. Peter the Apostle. Any other churchly institution is rank heresy, the child of Satan." So that was the conviction of the Jesuit fathers. Lenin once is supposed to have said that if I could only have had 12 men like the early Jesuits, my communism would have swept the world. And they began with one major function, and one alone, and that was to neutralize the Reformation. They had men like Father Peter Canisius, the hammer of the heretics. They went into Europe and they began driving the Reformation back. And when it was all over, they had recaptured half of Europe, parts of Germany, France, Poland, Austria, Hungary, Czechoslovakia. The great underbelly of Europe is back in the Catholic fold, largely as a result of this brilliant and committed order of individuals called the Jesuits. Now, I have earlier said, and I want to say again, that I admit I am fascinated by those people. They have disciplined mind, they have conviction, and I admire that in people. And quite frankly, I enjoy talking with them. It may sound strange to you, but I do. I can think of one Jesuit father who I was talking with at a shindig down here in Southern California, down in Hollywood. We were at a banquet. He and I got talking about the Second Coming, and I just thought, well, I'm going to see what his reaction will be to some Adventist eschatology, and I played it by him, and I finally said, "Father, it seems to me that the world is reaching a place where the only hope of humanity is the coming of Jesus." And you know what he said to me? He said, "Lou, I just love conversations like this. The only problem with them is they get me so excited I go home and I can't sleep." So I enjoy talking to them. Have some good friends in the order. I have many friends in the Catholic Church, and I have a deep admiration and respect for many of them. But their logic is like a steel trap. If you don't know the word, don't mess with them. And the Jesuit strategists have plans for the minimalists. In 1983, a couple of Jesuit theoreticians by the names of Karl Rahner and Heinrich Fries, working in the seminaries in Europe, I think in Austria and Germany, produced a book called Unity of the Churches, An Actual Possibility. This book is hard to find now. It is not in print. You can get a copy from some remainder houses who still have a few. I had to go to my alma mater, the Catholic U at San Diego, and research in their stacks to find the thing. And as I read this book by Fathers Rahner and Fries, I find at least five specific points upon which they say the Christian church can be brought back together again, the Reformation is gone, and we're all one people. Now let me give you my understanding of what these two men are saying. Point number one, they say first and foremost, you win over the thought leaders and the church leaders of the group you target. Go for leadership. Now, that only makes sense, doesn't it? If you can reach leadership, they in turn are thought leaders who can bring lots of people along with them. So point number one of the strategy by Rahner and Fries is win over thought leaders and church leaders. Point number two follows directly in track with that. It is expect to find and count on finding a liberal and submissive Protestant laity. Now, the theory there is that so many Protestants are so biblically illiterate and so uncommitted to anything that if you use a few good words like the cross, salvation, and so forth, if they hear that, it's good enough for them. Point number three. Form an ecumenical union of the churches. Now, what is interesting about this is that they're not saying that we should dissolve these churches and form one super church. They're saying, keep your church, God bless you. Keep your denomination. The thing can stand there and percolate along. No problem with it. Keep your structure. All you have to do is recognize the Holy Father as the guarantor of church unity. Now, is that too much a price to pay? Point number four. No church will reject any dogma held by a member church. You cannot reject out of hand a dogmatic truth held by another member church of this ecumenical union. And number five ties it all together. The ministers will exchange pulpits. You'll hear each Sunday or whenever you meet the pastor from various other churches. The theory for that is very reasonable. If there's more of a flow of information, people understand each other better, barriers are broken down, and the body of Christ can come back together. Now, do you see this very attractive and very reasonable sounding plan under the beautiful theme of ecumenism, love, and unity, we reunite the Christian church? How do you do it? Go for the thought leaders, count on a passive membership, make the plan seem kind of innocent by allowing the structure of the various churches to remain, but within them is a Trojan horse. You accept the leader of one of those churches as the guarantor of unity. And finally, you sew it all together with an exchange of pulpits. Well, will that plan work? Apparently, Karl Rahner thinks so, and for a couple of reasons. And I'm going to use his language so you can understand how he relates to you. Related to you, because he's dead. He died in 84. Number one, Protestants are, quote, and I'm quoting from Rahner's book, Protestants are, quote, passive, and therefore can be expected to follow their leaders into union with Rome. That book is actually a book about Rahner. It's promoting unity themes in Lutheran Catholic dialogue. The next quote I'm going to give you is, in fact, from Rahner's book, which is entitled Unity of the Churches. He says that liberal Protestant church leaders will do their political work beforehand. And let me read it to you in his words. The leaders of the churches of the Reformation will make sufficiently sure of the support of their members, end of quote, before they try an ecumenical union. And he says they'll be helped by the fact that most Protestants won't find union with the Catholic Church contrary to faith because, quote, of their liberal way of thinking. So there's the plan. Now, is there anything familiar about that plan? Yes, there is. That is how the Vatican performed its portion of the destruction of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Let me read it to you from the pen of Malachi Martin, page 43. The Pope decided, quote, on an end run around the Soviet party state. The Holy Father set about building closer ties with the Russian Orthodox Church. There were constant covert moves. Now, you understand that a covert move is the one that's hidden. That's the one under the table, see? There were constant covert moves. Later historians, with access to records unavailable today, will document the successes of John Paul's end run. Suffice it to say now that his effort nourished a core of priests and people eager to re-enter the mainstream of papal Rome. A deep change was being effected covertly within the Russian Orthodox believers that could lead to socio-political change. What are we saying? In so many words, we're saying you work from within, and you do it through a reunification of the churches. That's how Eastern Europe fell. Is there any indication that such a process may be going on in the churches here in America? That's the question. That's the $64 billion question for us. And my answer to you is, I think there is. I think the answer is yes. There are documents now in hand that establish a plan that is deeply mature, and in fact the groundwork for this reunification of churches goes back a whole generation. Go back to January 25, 1959. Believe it or not, I can still remember back that far. Pope John the 23rd has just been on the throne of St. Peter, so called at least, for 2 months. Very new in his pontificate, and he startles the world with this announcement he's going to call an ecumenical council. Now, what is startling about it is there have only been 20 of them in the whole history of the Catholic Church. This one will be number 21. But it will enter history as Vatican II for the simple reason that it will be held at the Vatican and it will be the second one to be held there. So into history comes this thing called Vatican II. And the process, the problem that they're trying to solve is how to make the Catholic Church more contemporary, more attractive to the non-Catholic Christian believer. And again, it's a very rational, very reasonable goal for them to have. Well, they met for several years working on the problem. And then they came up with a solution. You want to know what it is? They decided to change their form of worship. That's the way. See, back in 59, when Pope John the 23rd calls Vatican II, you folk who have Catholic backgrounds will remember that the priest said Mass with his back to you, facing the back wall of the church, and it was all in a language that you only partially understood, all in Latin. Vatican II comes along and says, no more of that, no more in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sanctus. It is now in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. They will speak the language of the people who are worshiping. And the altar gets turned around and the Eucharist sits there facing the people and the priest offers Mass facing the people. And so there is an effort now to popularize, bring into the popular mind the liturgy of the Roman Catholic Church. Well, along with that, they got to thinking, you know, we're dealing with late 20th century people. They're bored to death with religion. Back in 59, the world was not a very religious place. So they have to deal with this. And they got to thinking, let's kind of put our services in the language and mood of the people. And so they began to urge things like more physical movement in church. Now, the documents of Vatican II, page 84, put it this way. That there would be gestures and bodily attitudes, acclamations, responses, and singing. See, the whole point of this is get the people involved, actively, enthusiastically involved in the worship service. Get them moving. And along with that, occasionally do something a little theatrical to entertain them. People love to be entertained. In other words, make the church service meaningful for the people who are coming. And you'll attract more young people. You'll keep the people that otherwise wouldn't have come back to Mass. Well, a Catholic ecumenist with the name, oddly enough, of James White carried that idea one giant step further. And he wrote a book called New Forms of Worship. And he said, hey, if you want to have movement, Holy Father, let's do it this way. Let's have the whole congregation clasp arms at the shoulders and sway. Let's get moving here. Better yet, let's dance. Or have professional dancers do it. He says, I'd like to see the congregation dance, but if you can't do that because of constraints of space and time and so forth, get professional dancers on stage because they'll express with their bodies the joy that you ought to feel going to Mass. Well, a Jesuit by the name of Father Fox carried it even one step further, and he urged us to, quote, bring the body back to worship. Now, here's what he means by that. He said, stationary pews are terrible because they, quote, assure that no dance, no celebration of body-spirit might break loose. Books play a similar role. If people have to hold books, they aren't free to move the body, to dance, to respond to the good news. So Fox's idea is get the people physically involved in worship and the Mass will mean more to them. Well, interestingly enough, these ideas began to kind of go out collaterally into Protestantism. And back in 89, there was a good, well-intended brother by the name of Robert Myers who printed a little tract called Proposal for a Joint Worldwide Movement. And his whole thing is, let's get the Christian world reunited again, Catholics, Orthodox, Protestants. And let's reach the world for Jesus. And here's how he thinks we ought to do that. And I'll use his language as a direct quote. Praising God in song with lively music, psalms, hymns, and contemporary music. Our worship services must be more lively. We should show some enthusiasm like people do at athletic events or concerts. We should clap our hands, stamp our feet, raise our hands, and give each other holy hugs. Why not some drama? Let there be variety. So this idea begins to collaterally spread from the Catholic world out into the Protestant world. Now, I happen to know all this because once again, I just happen to be standing in the right place at the right time. In the 1960s, when all of this began to come down and the changes began to occur in the Catholic Church, I was a graduate student on a Catholic campus. And I found the changes, quite frankly, fascinating. Some of them were kind of attractive. I was a young person. They appealed to the young mind. And along with all the other changes, they did something I couldn't fail to notice. They began to change their music. Now, I couldn't miss that. Because at the time they did it, I was working as a disc jockey. For 6 years while I was in school, worked my way, in, at least in part, paid my tuition and some of my board and room, working on any radio station that would have me. And I worked on some small ones and some large ones. Some were classical music. Some of the music was so deeply classical, I swear you could listen to it and never wake up. You could have a root canal and you wouldn't know it. And some of it was middle-of-the-road Montavani, Ray Conniff. By the way, I worked with Ray Conniff's son at one station. Very nice fellow. And Ray himself was a prince of a man. So I played some of this. And then, in my flaming and ill-directed youth, I also worked for a rock station. And I began to notice that the music I was hearing as I went by or went into Mass was no longer always the kind of sedate organ music and Gregorian chant you think you'll hear coming from the open door of a Catholic church. Increasingly, what I heard reminded me of what I was playing on the air. Now, let me tell you a little bit about music, a little bit about rock music, I think I understand enough to say something about it. See, I was with the station, the radio station in Southern California that first brought the Beatles to the Hollywood Bowl. Basically, rock is a repetitious, rhythmically driven music that derives much of its power from accentuating the secondary beat. Now, think about it, and you'll recognize that most music emphasizes the first beat. The Sousa March tells you where your left foot ought to be and when, doesn't it? Not too hard to relate to. Somehow the rhythms of the mind can relate to music that accentuates the primary beat. When you interrupt that and accentuate the secondary beat, something goes a little goofy in the head. You don't know where your left foot ought to be, you just know it ought to be moving. And it gets doing that, doesn't it? It has an undeniable power. I can well remember when I used to go out to schools, I'd take these little promo pictures of the Beatles. You know, they were still wearing neckties in those days. They had long hair, but they hadn't come into the hard acid rock we would see just within a couple of years. And the kids would line up and besiege us for these things. They would line up for the buses to go into the Hollywood Bowl to see these guys play. All I had to do was open the mic and tell them they were listening to the sound of the Mighty 590, the sound of music for all of Southern California, and tell them that I would take the next request that came in, and zip, 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 all six phone lines lit up. You don't have a bell in a broadcast studio. The phone doesn't ring for obvious reasons, but it lights up. And I knew there was power there that I frankly didn't fully understand. Now then, recently I've done a little bit of research because I was curious about this. What is it about music that evokes these powerful responses in us? And I discovered that a couple of researchers by the names of Shillian and Shane, way back in the 40s, did some research which led them to the following conclusion, that music is perceived through the portion of the brain receiving the stimulus of emotions, sensations, and feelings without first being subjected to reason and intelligence. Now, let me give it to you in their words. Music, which does not depend upon the master brain to gain entrance into the organism, can still arouse by way of the thalamus, the relay station of all our emotion, sensation, and feeling. Once a stimulus has been able to reach the thalamus, the master brain is automatically invaded. What are they saying? In simple terms, they're saying there's a back door for the brain, and music can get there. Now, more recently, there have been some studies done that have given a series of clinical findings as to what clinicians have discovered music does to you physiologically. And I want to just share those with you, not because I want to put you to sleep on a warm Sabbath afternoon, but because there is information here that just might be useful to you as you analyze how you relate to things, including how you relate to the worship of God. Now then, the first conclusion is that music is perceived and enjoyed without necessarily being interpreted by the higher centers of the brain. That's the back door. Point number two. Response to music is measurable even though the listener is not giving conscious attention to it. And I think if you'll think about that, you recognize it's true. Your mood can be altered even though the music is not consciously in your mind, it's just happening. Best example of this is Muzak, the kind of background music that is played. I worked at one radio station where we also babysat the Muzak tapes that went out to businesses all over the city. And they would program certain kinds of music for certain times of day. When you're shopping, you're not generally consciously aware of what's playing, but it generates a mood in you, which the merchant naturally hopes will be that of parting with your money. Point number three. There is evidence that music can bring about mood changes by affecting body chemistry and electrolyte balance. Now, down here sits my wife, who's a surgeon, and I sometimes hear her talking with her dad or with other doctors worrying about the electrolyte balance in a post-surgical patient. And it is my understanding from my hearing this for a few years that if you get your electrolytes out of whack, you can get very sick very quick. They're profoundly important to you, and clinicians have apparently determined that electrolyte balance and body chemistry can, in fact, be affected by music. Point number four, by lowering the level of sensory perception, music heightens the responses to color, touch, and other sensory perceptions. And I think that's reasonably clear. Why else would Hollywood spend so much money putting a dynamite soundtrack behind John Wayne as he rides into the sunset? Number five, it has been demonstrated that music affects changes in muscular energy and promotes or inhibits body movement. Well, that one's pretty clear. Just park at a red light in front of a teenager who's got their boombox going. They are moving. I have sometimes wondered if there's a great deal of cerebration going on there, but they're moving. Number six, highly repetitive rhythmic music has a hypnotic effect. And number seven, the sense of hearing has a greater effect on the autonomic nervous system than any of the other senses. Now, what was going on in the Catholic Church? They were changing their form of music. They were moving to a style of music that more and more tread on the fringes of a rock mentality. And one wonders what connection that may have with the perception of religious truth. Well, there's an interesting study done in the journal Adventist Perspectives, Volume 2. This is published by the Religion Department at Southern College. You want a copy of this? I think you could probably get to that resource by writing Dr. Jack Blanco at Southern College or otherwise looking it up in one of our major libraries. Very probably it's available at the library at Loma Linda. And this journal reported that a major evangelist discovered that when he switched to a folk rock music in his meetings, the numbers of commitments rose sharply. He was getting response. The people came down the aisle more than they had ever come before. So there obviously was an emotional appeal there. But now, as Paul Harvey would say, let's hear the rest of the story. He later found that the percentage of these that completed his follow-up program had fallen from his previous 20% to less than 1%. They're reacting with emotion. It doesn't last. They don't stay. Well, Ellen White once said in Counsels to Parents and Teachers, I think if I can read my writing correctly here, it's page 94. If you lower the standard in order to secure popularity and an increase in numbers, and then make this increase a cause of rejoicing, you show great blindness. If numbers were an evidence of success, Satan might claim the preeminence. Now, as the music changed in the Catholic service, something happened. In the Catholic world, I was watching as a fascinated, bemused onlooker. Something happened in 1966. It happened at Duquesne University. It spread like grass fire to Notre Dame. It went to other Catholic campuses. It was the beginning of the Catholic charismatic movement. Something happened. Now, as I understand it, one day at Duquesne, there's a little group of these new Catholics around. There were some fathers, there were some lay people, there were students, and they decided to pray for the Holy Spirit. Hands were laid on, and as soon as they were, the unknown tongue began to sprout. Glossolalia. Pentecostalism in 1966. Now a mighty bridge had been built between churches that were formerly anathema to each other. Pentecostalism and the Catholic faith were linking up. Now, let me refer you to a book you might like to get a hold of and read. There is a Catholic priest by the name of Edward O'Connor, and he's written a book called The Pentecostal Movement in the Catholic Church. And he describes what it was, how it happened, where it led. Said that, and I'm quoting now from Father O'Connor, after the close of the first or second part of the meeting, anyone who has requested prayer kneels or sits in the middle of the room, and the others gather around him, laying their hands on his head. This form of prayer is always used when the baptism in the Holy Spirit is being sought. Now, the question you might want to ask is, where did that lead? It led to a neo-Pentecostalism in the Catholic Church, and that new Pentecostalism brought with it new conviction for the Catholic students who were going through this. You know what conviction it brought? That the Holy Eucharist is the most blessed thing one could ever hope to find in the worship of God. Let me read it to you from Father O'Connor's book here. Many have commented on how much more meaningful the Mass has become. One student remarked that the Eucharist meant so much to him that he was glad to summon all the angels and saints of heaven to join him in giving thanks for it. When another student received the baptism in the Spirit, his first instinct upon returning to the university was to go to the chapel. There he sat for an hour in wondering adoration before the Blessed Sacrament, drawn toward the tabernacle by a force that seemed almost physical. Why? Because the host was on the altar. And that's what makes a Catholic Church sacred to them. Now, I learned that the hard way. See, the reason I spent so much time in some of these churches was that at the Immaculata Cathedral, where I was a student, there was an old theater organ. It only had about 5 working ranks, but what was left was glorious. And the whole church was marble. There was just about 2 acres of solid marble, so the acoustics were like nothing this side of the kingdom of heaven. And I wanted to get my hands on that organ. So I went to Father Kiefer, and I said, you know, if you'll just let me practice, if you have a time when somebody doesn't show up, I'll play hymns for you for Mass. I'll sit in, but I will need to practice on the organ. Well, he let me in there, and one night I was playing that thing. I went into the chambers, and I discovered that the weights could still be moved on the tremulant chest, and I moved them. When I turned the trem tabs on, that thing was right back in the Chinese theater. You know, it was just singing its heart out. Wild theatrical tremulant. And I got carried away, and I just couldn't help it. I played a popular song. I think it was something like Gigi. And up the stairs came Father Kiefer. And I felt bad about that. You know, I don't agree with some of this stuff, but I respect the convictions of other people. But I learned that when the host is on the altar, you don't mess with that place. See, we were still early on in this particular experience, and this new music hadn't quite hit the Immaculata Parish. And so, the point I'm making is, when Pentecostalism entered Catholicism, the thing it brought with it was a conviction that the Mass was valid and should be loved. By their fruits, ye shall know them. Now that brings me to the real point of Vatican II. As I read the documents, I happen to have the old, earlier translation of the documents of Vatican II. I have on order the newer books, and some of these pages that I have cited you to as I have read through the book, I have gotten from a secondary source. I hope they are accurate. I haven't proofread them myself. There is nothing I hate worse than to read into a tape a citation that's wrong. That happened to me up in Northern California. As I was getting ready this material for these talks just recently, I discovered something. Something or somebody doesn't like this so good. As I was using my word processor, and I have used it before, I know how to use the thing. I would enter a revision of an outline of my notes, put it in the word processor, and then when I would come back and try to retrieve it, the revision wasn't there. The old one was still in there. And then when I went to copy this stuff on my copier, it wouldn't copy. I mean, stuff with print on it, face down on the copier, came out blank pages. I had to pray over that machine before I got the copies I'm using. And in the confusion that resulted, I erroneously attributed some statements with respect to the Eucharist and the reunification of the churches to Malachi Martin in Keys of His Blood, and actually they are out of the documents of Vatican II. Now, I don't know how saying that here will help the folks who are listening to those tapes, but at least I've done all I know how to do. And I deeply regret citing incorrectly, because you should be able to go look these sources up and find what I'm referring to. That's why I give you these sources. Well, anyway, in the documents of Vatican II, it seems quite clear as I read them that one of the major goals of the Ecumenical Council was to narrow the gap between the Protestant Communion and the Roman Catholic Mass. Between the Lord's Supper and the notion that he can be sacrificed again and again and again and again, just as often as a priest says Mass. Now, there is an unimaginable gulf between true Protestantism and Catholicism. One of the deepest chasms in this gulf is whether Christ can repeatedly be sacrificed again. The sincere Catholic believes that any time that wafer is on the altar and the priest prays over it, that Jesus becomes physically and bodily present there. The sincere Protestant goes into the Word, Hebrews 9:28, so Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many. And Adventism goes one giant step further, and he tells you what he's doing in the heavenly sanctuary now. Now, apparently, there's something pretty vital here. Because even mighty Moses, one of the greatest men that ever lived, and who now, God help me, can be hearing what I'm saying about him. Even Moses lost translation over that issue. He struck the rock a second time, thus symbolically sacrificing the Son of God again. The Lord said, Moses, I'm sorry, but it's going to have to be through the grave. Now, either Christ is on the altar in the wafer in response to a prayer of a priest, or he's in the heavenly sanctuary mediating his one sacrifice. You can't have it both ways. And either we are Protestants out of the Word alone, Adventists driven by the book, or we have mutated, losing sight of a vital truth called the heavenly sanctuary. Now, what I'm saying is you cannot harmonize the Protestant communion and the Roman Catholic Eucharist. Now, you can love Catholics, and I happen to. As a gesture of respect and not of spiritual obeisance, you can talk to a Catholic priest and you can call him Father, and I do. I've caught some flack for that. But I tell you, I'd rather err on the side of people I'm trying to reach. You can admire the conviction of people, and I do. But you can't harmonize the Protestant Communion and the Catholic Mass. And one of the great goals of the Vatican II Council was to bring these two together. Now let me read it to you from the documents of Vatican II. Documents, page 515. I hope the citation is correct. It's a secondary reference. And I'm quoting. When the obstacles hindering perfect ecclesiastical communion have been surmounted, the unity of all Christians may at last be restored to a single new people celebrating one Eucharistic mystery. The document is Spiritus Domini, done April of 1970. Let me read it to you another way, because they don't say it just once. No Christian community can be built up unless it has as its basis the Holy Eucharist. The supreme manifestation of this is the Sunday assembly on which, by apostolic tradition, the Paschal mystery is celebrated. Any endeavor that seeks to make Sunday a genuine day of rest should be encouraged. Now, do you see where Sunday will come from? where the entry point is. And the entry point will ride right along with the Eucharist and a rejoining of the Protestant Communion and the Catholic Mass. I'll give you one more statement. The one I just read, I believe, was from Documents of Vatican II, page 117. Let me give you one more. The Spirit of the Lord is at work in the present ecumenical movement, for all peoples are called to be a single new people, celebrating one Eucharistic mystery. Well, there is a plan by Karl Rainer Heinrich Fries, Jesuit theoreticians of unparalleled tactical brilliance. Question is the plan working? Working? It's been adopted by the World Council of Churches, and they have a book out on it, and the title is Baptism and Eucharist, Ecumenical Convergence in Celebration. And it talks openly of, quote, approved alternatives to today's established churches. Now, you remember Father Rainer's idea, get the thought leaders first, go for them, and the flock will come along. Let's listen to some Protestant thought leaders. An Episcopalian priest and professor. If the Holy Spirit says that church unity is through the Bishop of Rome, who are we to accuse the Holy Spirit of bad theology? Presbyterian pastor. He saw no reason, quote, not to accept the Pope as the earthly Lord of creation. Even the fundamentalist churches give clear, striking evidence of a profound infiltration of thought that they themselves do not even understand. You know why? Because they believe in the rapture. That is dispensationalism. That is the work of Father Francisco Ribera, a Jesuit who was designing his answer to the argument from the Reformation that the little horn of Daniel 7 was the papacy. Well, a question we better be asking is, could it happen in Adventism? That is a private matter for your own conscience. I love this church. I believe in this church. And when I say church, I mean this organized church. But this church deserves the best you can give it, including defense of truth when that is necessary. In the privacy of your own conscience, you decide that if any of this could ever be a threat to Adventism, maybe not, and if not, praise the Lord. I'd rather have peace than war, wouldn't you? But as you make those decisions, just review the Jesuit plan. Win the thought leaders. Develop a tolerance for the doctrines of other churches. Count on a passive laity and well-organized thought leaders who will do their political homework well. Begin with a revitalized worship format that will shake people loose from old thought patterns. And keep your church structure, you can have it. Just accept the Holy Father as the guarantor of unity. Before the last developments of the work of apostasy, there will be a confusion of faith. One truth after another will be corrupted. Maranatha, 192. And I close this evening with a text from volume 5, page 136, that I chose without embarrassment or apology as the theme quotation for my book, Omega. When the religion of Christ is held most in contempt, when his law is most despised, then should our zeal be the warmest and our courage and firmness the most unflinching. At this time, we must gather warmth from the coldness of others, courage from their cowardice, loyalty from their treason. To stand in defense of truth and righteousness when the majority forsake us. To fight the battles of the Lord when champions are few. This will be our test.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.